Welcome to Way Back When with your hosts, Lisa and Nancy.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Big Blend Radio's Authors Show with Books Forward. Today, we're excited to chat with Kimberly Hess, and she's joining us to talk about a biography that she wrote about the life of Sarah B. Cochran, known as the Coal Queen. It's out now. It's called A Lesser Mortal, The Unexpected Life of Sarah B. Cochran. And you can get it now. It's out everywhere. Is it Cochran or Cochran? You know, everybody's got a different way. But welcome, Cochran. Kimberly. Cochran. Get there. Because now this Sarah's actually like a distant relative, right?
Right. She was my great-great-grandmother's cousin.
Wow. So This is really interesting when we talk about women's history because, and I think this is what's really cool about your book too, is you write her biography, but she's not like a famous person that we all know. And I think there's so many women, we don't know what they do because at one point women were livestock at one point, right? Mm-hmm. And then it's like whenever they were doing anything in business, it was really the man's name on it, or they were put as a widow, right? And that's the same thing for Sarah.
Right. Yeah, many times her expertise or her responsibilities just weren't necessarily recorded. If you look at different records, and if you were trying to find her, I think it would be difficult to find her if you didn't already know where to look.
Mm-hmm. So Sarah, you know, you look at her life, so there's philanthropy, right? And so that is a lot of times what women did, especially back then. It was especially if they had a well-off husband, it's like, okay, we're philanthropy, but they still had their finger in some of the business dealings, especially she did. Was that kind of covered over when you were doing research about her, about, you know, being more than philanthropy?
Well, it's interesting because it's represented a little differently in different places. And I think it had something to do with what the writer knew of her at the time. And maybe some of it just had to do with how records were kept too. I noticed that local newspapers seemed to talk about her philanthropy and her business dealings. But in other places, as you got further away from the locality where she was from, she was known more as the coal magnate's widow or as a philanthropist. And in one brief obituary for her, it was about three sentences long. She was called a philanthropist. Her husband was considered the business person. Mm-hmm. And so it's delineated very differently in different records. Even the census for an occupation just wrote a blank space in one case, in none another year. And she had the same responsibilities as her husband did, and he had an actual occupation listed in the census when he was alive, I think as Coke manufacturer. So, you know, it suggested that he was doing something, but she was still being portrayed as the coal magnate or the capitalist's wife, instead of magnate in her own right.
This is interesting too, because you talk about the coal, you know, the coal queen, right? And then also it was coal and coke. And so Nancy and I both said, you know, when you come on the show, we need to talk about what coke is, because there's coke, Coca-Cola, and then there's the cocaine, and this is
yes,
right? So let's talk about what coke is, just to clear that up now.
Right, so the coke that we're talking about is a byproduct of coal, and it's made from bituminous coal. That's the softer coal that you find in western Pennsylvania. Basically, if you take bituminous coal out of the ground and put it in a brick oven for several days so that it can heat or bake for several thousand degrees for a couple of days, you end up with this product called coke that's getting closer to pure carbon. And that's used in the steel making process. So that's what coke so lucrative for people like the Cochran family and Henry Clay Frick, who's more associated with that industry than the Cochrans.
And I know her life is also part of Pennsylvania. And, you know, this last year during COVID, we did do a lot of travel through Pennsylvania. And, you know, just even before we recorded, we found out we didn't know really where we were. But we went all over. But what was one of the places that Well, we went to Lancaster Ridge, okay, in Pennsylvania. So that's more the Amish country, right? And right. then we were in Chad's Ford on the Brandywine Creek area. Yeah. Beautiful. We did all these bed and breakfasts. We went up to Easton, Pennsylvania. But when Easton, Pennsylvania and Erie, Pennsylvania, both were very industrial history, like Easton, Pennsylvania, you know, the beginning of Crayola, our crayons, you know. And then Easton was so industrial. It was interesting. I mean, they had the Millionaire's Row kind of thing. And a lot of that happened in a lot of the back, you know, the cities we went to back east had these, or the Silk Stocking Row or whatever, they would have a different title of being, this is the la-di-da place and we manufactured. But I remember steel being a big deal. So that's what they were part of. They were, you know, all these towns made it because, and Carnegie, you got to think about Carnegie and steel, right? And so that wouldn't have happened without them, Sarah's husband and her.
Right. And there were other operators working in coal and coke in that region at the time that are generally unknown by this point. But that whole area was so prosperous from coal and coke because that the product that they were creating as coke was cheaper to produce than what could be produced from the coal closer to Pittsburgh. And it was considered a superior product when it was all said and done too. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of prosperity in the Connellsville region of southwestern Pennsylvania in Fayette County and the surrounding areas around 1900 and the late 19th century.
Wow.
So how did the other companies view her coming, you know, when Sarah comes into this whole thing and now she's taking over from her husband? Did you find very much information on how the other companies viewed her?
No, because the information I was going with was public information like the Pennsylvania mining reports that didn't really get into so much. It was more statistical and more information about what the industry was doing. I would also look at historic newspapers and I could see a little more detail about what she was doing and in some cases how she was interacting with other people in the industry. Mm-hmm. But I never came across a diary or letters from her where she kind of laid out her feelings about any interactions. The closest thing that I found was a historic newspaper article from December 1904 that was local to where she lived. And it was talking about the man who was a manager in her largest coal and coke operation and how he was hosting what was known as a smoker at that time. A smoker was an event for men only because the assumption was that they would be smoking and that wasn't appropriate for women to do. So it was automatically all male. And it was an event where men from the coal industry, the railroads, banks, even one that Sarah founded or was credited with founding, were all invited. And then she is listed as being there, but not as a guest, but to help the man's daughters provide pleasant entertainment and conversation. So it's not clear.
Okay.
Yeah. It's clear that she doesn't quite fit into the industry at that point. Mm-hmm. It's not clear if this man was inviting her and trying to find a way to shoehorn her into the sort of social norms of the time so that she could be among her peers in a way mm-hmm. that would otherwise be socially acceptable. You know, that was, I think, the closest thing that I found to information about how she fit. I had heard when I was growing up, just within my own family, that Henry Clay Frick really looked at her business as her husband's. And I never really heard what that meant. And there wasn't any particular story to go with that. But I did come across information at a very general level about, division of business and home life between men and women in the 19th century and the fact that business and politics were really seen as a man's world and
sure.
long there at the time and women were considered, you know, the moral authority in the home and all of this. So I think what my family might have been talking about when they would talk about Frick's perception of her in business was really just what everybody thought of women's places in the 19th century.
But I think women, they say behind every great man is a great woman. I think that women really did have a role. It just was, you know, the men came out and did what they wanted to do, but women talked to him and helped make decisions all the time.
And Sarah and her mother-in-law were even listed on deeds for the sale of two mines with their horses and mules and small railroads that went through it. I mean, it was clearly an industrial operation and not just somebody's house with a garden shed or something. So it wasn't clear to me exactly how they were involved in the business, if at all, or what was going on. But it seemed like maybe their husbands saw them a little more equally than what society saw women generally at the time.
So doing the research of this, I find this fascinating. I know, Nancy, you know, we do so much on family history on our shows. It becomes a thing. And the research you went through, I think, is something that can inspire others to research our women history. I mean, the men is a little bit, like you're saying, it's a little bit easier to find, but maybe not for women. Any tips on, like, you know, just what you just were saying also about, like, oh, there was this smoker event. And, you know, normally we may just bypass that because you don't see her name immediately, or it's not like a ta-da, Sarah was here. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to look at some of the other things that are male centric, basically, to find where the women fit in.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I found a lot of information about her by going to the organizations that she was associated with, either through her donations or where she served as a trustee. The church that she built in Dawson had some information about her. But I think generally, you know, it's good to try to read different histories about women in particular eras to know a little bit about what's going on. And that generally provides clues about what sorts of documents and sorts of places might hold information about particular women. Mm. You know, I did some reading of Alice Kessler Harris's book, Out to Work, that was about women's labor, and that was very eye-opening and presented another perspective on what women were doing that might give people ideas if they are interested in doing research on women who worked or on women who were wealthy enough, like Sarah, that they didn't necessarily have to work. So that was very helpful in this case. And a lot of it too was genealogical information that I had done years ago through her mother's side of the family, who was a sibling to my third great grandfather. So sometimes general genealogical information and research helps to uncover a lot about these women.
Wow, this is cool. Wow. Yeah. I mean, when you think about women's roles and how they've changed through history, and I think we've always, like I said, had our finger in the pie. We've always done it, and just, we have to just dress up how we say it. You know, it's like, okay, we may not get the title, but in 100 years we do, you know. So going into this, was this more of a women's movement thing for you, or did you just get really go down a rabbit hole of family history? I mean, it's... Because this was not a couple years research.
Yeah, it was interesting because I've always felt very strongly about helping to advance women. I mean, I went to as I wanted to study at a college that had a legacy of educating women to do anything that men had done, and doing this before women were even admitted at some colleges. And it was partially just the way I was brought up. I was always told stories about the women in my family who were involved in the suffrage movement or other things. And that was how I knew of Sarah to begin with. But for me, I came to writing the book because about, I guess, 6 years ago, I took my husband to southwestern Pennsylvania so he could see where my family was from. And he started Googling Sarah when I was telling him about her, and he couldn't find information about her online. And he said, "No, you should put something online. You could write a Wikipedia entry for her. And I liked that idea. So I did a little bit of research and wrote the entry. And then I started doing a couple of blog posts for some museums and decided from there that I was doing enough research and answering some questions and starting to find more questions that I wanted to learn more about. It just kind of organically led to writing a book, even though that wasn't the original intention.
Wow.
I think it's exciting because, I think you also bring up a point of, this research, and you go to museums in a town, sometimes you don't know much about the town, but you go in these small museums and you'll see like one photo of somebody, a woman, maybe a grand, with their grandchild, like you're the intro of your book. You've got, your photo in there. And, who were these women? What were they doing? And we've got to ask. I mean, we don't all have to write a book, but I think even just getting involved and sharing these women's stories, you'll start to dig and find that they did far more than what we know, far more, because it was kind of, oh, she's a good lady.
She's so nice.
She's so special.
The wife and the mother. Wife, mother, keep the house clean, or at least look over to make somebody's keeping it clean.
Yeah. And even now we're still finding stuff, it's like, and if we don't keep sharing these stories, I think, we look at women moving forward in life, that we need to have that aspiration of women before us. Because, each generation has their, case of challenges, and each challenge is going to be different. But one thing that stays true is like not giving up and finding a way. And so those stories are really important. And it's not always the famous women that should be the important story, even though she was, excuse me, but badass.
Such a gracious
I think there used to be this feeling that women were not supposed to delve into money matters. It was unseemly to be looking at money and to be able to, even if you were a bookkeeper, you weren't supposed to be able mentally to have the concept of saving money, investing money, using money. You were just like, oh, go take care of it kind of thing. So I think when we look back in history at where women used to be and where we are, we have really come forward a lot further than we sometimes think. If you really look at some of the things that you weren't supposed to do and what we have done. It's like now there's a lot of women lawyers and a lot of women accountants and CPAs
and a vice president.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm just saying, whatever side you like, but I mean, there's still a woman vice president.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's strange too to think about how some things have taken so long to change, because when I out that article about the smoker event in 1904, I think about Muriel Siebert being the first woman to have a seat on the New York Stock Exchange. And there was a story in the obituary, I don't know if it was in the last 10 years or so, but it talked about how the meetings that different organizations that she was a part of on Wall Street were still meeting in all male clubs in New York City.
Oh, funny.
In the 60s. When she was coming to this this particular part of her career, and she had to walk through the kitchen and up a fire escape to get to the meeting room, where she was the only woman in the room. And I've thought about that different times since reading about Sarah Smoker, where we know you're part of the group, but we can't really talk about how you're part of the group publicly because that will offend certain sensibilities or something, or the rules haven't caught up to what the reality is yet.
Oh, wow. So it's really hard if you're researching to be able to find that information because it's not written down, because it's a no-no at that point. And then
I think so.
Unless the woman wrote it down somewhere in her journal or something.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think a lot of probably come up in journals and diaries or letters. Mm-hmm. And I was in letters between her and certain women like Ida Tarbell, who was on, she was associated with Allegheny College at the same time. Because Ida was an alumna representative to the Board of Trustees when Sarah was the first female trustee at the college. But there doesn't seem to be correspondence between the two in Ida's papers.
What was Sarah's, her maiden name?
Moore.
Moore. So she's got, you know, English heritage then maybe. Okay.
Yeah. I know her father's family was supposed to have migrated from Massachusetts to Western Pennsylvania. Mm. And I'm related to her on her mom's side. And that side, which is the Herberts, actually traces to Monmouth County, New Jersey in the Revolution and to a common ancestor that we have who was in the military on the American side in the Revolution and then found his way to Western Pennsylvania and ultimately to Central Ohio.
Oh, wow. So did you go any further back into England and Scotland, Wales history with any of the genealogy?
No, it's interesting because when you start looking at the Herberts in Monmouth County, there's all of this speculation about how the Herberts got here from England. And it seems to get into legend and folklore rather than actual facts. And I don't have experience with genealogical research before the Revolution so much. So I didn't want to get into too much of that. I thought was a good stopping point. But one of the myths that comes up when you're doing research on that particular family is, are they descended from English earls or not? Mm-hmm. It seems likely, but it was interesting to me because there were times when Sarah wasn't accepted in society in Western Pennsylvania because she was from such humble financial beginnings. And it's interesting to me that she may be descended from English royalty and wasn't accepted in certain society.
Wow. We're gonna have to connect you with Glenn, our friend Glenn. Mm-hmm. He's our family history expert over in Norfolk, England. And we do, we connect. Mm. Yeah, we have an English connection story as we travel. Like, I know you work with Books Forward. We do literary landmarks across the country where we document, you know, stories. So when we get to Eastern Pennsylvania, we'll be calling you.
Okay.
To say, hey, we were here in Sarah's land. But yeah, we'll have to contact him on this because maybe he can like do some research on that side. You never know. But it is, do you feel like when you were doing this that you started unraveling other women's stories beyond Sarah?
I unraveled more of my great-grandmother's story than I necessarily knew before because I grew up knowing that Sarah put her through college to be a teacher. And then she didn't teach very long because she got married and she had three children. Mm. This really forced me to look at information about my great-grandmother a little bit differently or in more depth. I have her yearbook from what's now Indiana University of Pennsylvania and saw information about how she played basketball when she was there.
Wow.
I'd always played basketball, but I found out that she was the guard on the team and that they defeated, I think, some other colleges in a championship with Ohio. So it sounded like she had this great experience in college. And I included a picture from her room in the book, just to show an example of women studying in college around 1917 or 1918, because so many times pictures of men.
Yes, pictures of men, and then even 1917, you got to think, Nancy, even when you wanted to go to college, your father's like, that's it, you're a nurse. That's the only thing you can be, a teacher or a nurse. And that's, you know, you've got to think like, about,
No, I don't want to be a nurse for sure.
No.
It's interesting because there's so much about women that is written, and you don't know how much the times influence the writing. So how much of what you're reading is true, and how much of it are they going by guidelines that are accepted? You know, so that the women come out almost looking like they're all the same, unless somebody's really bad. and does something really crazy, then you're like, oh, this is a villainous woman, or like somebody, you know, and you're like in the old West, you look at people like Annie Oakley, and now she's going to get her shotgun out and all that kind of thing. You, unless there's somebody really, really different, it's really hard to find information that you can rely on about women.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I never knew until I was working on the book that Sarah was associated with her son's fraternity. Her son died in college and he was a member of Phi Kappa Psi. So after he died, she became involved financially as a benefactor and built a house for the fraternity at Allegheny College, bought a house for the chapter at West Virginia University. But the West Virginia University chapter, the Alpha chapter, had so much information about Sarah in their chapter history book.
Wow,
and they seemed to appreciate her. To the point that the chapter even named their fraternity house for her when they moved a few years after she died. So I thought that was, because a lot of women in her era seemed to be philanthropically involved. They seemed to get involved with things like the kindergarten movement or orphanages or something very maternal. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of perplexed when I saw the association with the fraternity, but it made perfect sense as I thought more about her son being involved and the fact that the fraternity chapter in Morgantown really viewed her as the mother of the fraternity chapter. So she was still taking on that maternal role, but just in a different way, and basically keeping in touch with grown men that she might be able to mentor or network with. Was a different way of being a maternal figure to kindergarten students or orphans.
That's interesting. It's different. And then at the same time, she really cared a lot about education, which I think is important too. That seems to be her, you know, move forward, get education and invest in that, but hands on.
Was putting people through college very quietly. I mean, we don't even know who she put through college without people's descendants self-identifying, assuming that they know. But you know, she was involved as a trustee at American University and at Allegheny and at Beaver College. And she built dormitories at Otterbein University and at Allegheny College. So for someone who had little education herself and probably really wanted to be educated as she was growing up, she was very involved and saw the value in it, and easily could have just said, I didn't have that much education and look what I have, so why does anyone else need it? But she took a very different approach.
That's interesting. And it's interesting that she was looking at, you know, men too, and young men, and helping them. I think, you know, that's something interesting, because I think when you look at even today, like the women's movement is almost negates men. And how do we all come together if we don't have that connection and learning together? So I think it's good what she was doing on that level, because men have to learn more about women and not just be led by men, you know?
Right. And I wonder if that has anything to do with the fact that she was the only woman in this industry of coal manufacturing. If she was just very comfortable working with men and understood that she needed to be a certain sort of diplomat to be able to survive in an industry and in a time when there weren't going to be that many other people like her working with her.
Because I know a lot of women in construction world, and it's a different, they can have water on their backs, like, you know, they're like a duck, they're like, okay, we can hear anything, we can handle anything, but there is that connection, and it is a little different. So I wonder if it is more that way, you know, when back in the day, when you think about the mining times, you know, and mining is an industry. It's a hard industry, but it's also, you know, it also has its Lottie Daw side, where people go to fancy balls and all of that, you know? So, you know, with this book coming out, what is, when you said, okay, I'm going to start writing this, I mean, did you feel like you were rabbit holing? Did you feel like, oh my gosh, how am I going to, you know, how much work? I can just kind of see you burrowing when like a gazillion papers and traveling around and getting documents everywhere. And just, you know, how did you kind of be able to rein it all in to get the pathway of the book?
Well, I made an outline based on the sorts of questions that I wanted to answer. And I really hoped that I could find more information about what agency she had in business and what she was doing exactly, and exactly what companies she owned, because she's spoken of with respect to the industry, but then when you want to find out exactly what she owned, it's a little more difficult. But I had to just set my own parameters. I wasn't going to research her travels overseas because it just seemed like that might not add as much to the story, and it could be a lot of extra work, possibly, you know, outside of what I would have the capacity to do. There were some other areas too. You know, I didn't want to get into writing house histories about Lyndon Hall or histories of particular structures. I wanted to talk about what might have been important to her or how she might have used that particular structure, but I didn't want to get into, you know, deeds that passed between different people for land. I just had to decide where I was drawing the line for any of that.
Yeah, because she had a big life.
She did, yeah. And it's interesting how documentation there is and how much there isn't. I was hoping to find more about her business work. And in a lot of cases, the records don't exist anymore for particular companies. Or if there are any records, maybe an individual might have them in a collection, but I don't know who that would be. You know, you're depending on the state mining reports and historic newspapers to determine when she was buying and selling different mines, or to learn that she had lease agreements with other companies to work in mines that she owned. So there were certain things that I just outlined as areas that I wanted to know more about. And then as I went on with research, it seemed like doors opened and there were more threads of information. For example, you know, the fraternity association was a surprise, but I found out that she had Henry J. Hines at her house for lunch when she was hosting the Methodist Bishops of the World for their semi-annual meeting.
Wow.
It was the first time at a private residence that these bishops had met. And I wondered what would have brought Hines to this meeting. So I found a brief biography of him. And it was talking about how he was involved in the Pennsylvania State Sabbath School Association that was involved with Sunday school at the time in the US and overseas. And I remembered seeing my great grandmother's certificate from that organization from about 1913 or so. And I contacted the Historical Society of Pennsylvania and asked them to check in their records. It was during COVID, so I couldn't go myself. But they have the records for the organization, and they were able to check and confirm that she actually financed or sponsored a particular universal exposition of Sunday schools in 1907 in Rome. And I had never heard anything about that. So sometimes just one question, like in this case about Hines being at lunch, led to all of this other information about things that she did and things that she might have been involved with. And just because of the issues, I chose not to keep following the Sunday school information or to do with her travel overseas.
You could, yeah, because that's what I say, talk about a rabbit hole. You could keep going and going and going and never get the book out, right? Do you feel like what you've done also inspires other women to research women in their history to document it, their lives?
I hope it does. I mean, that was one of the reasons I wanted to write it, because I think there are so many people, women especially, like you were saying, who just aren't part of the historical narrative, or they're known very well locally, but when people move away or as populations get older, then perhaps that person's memory isn't known well. And there's a question of where the documents about those women go. And in some cases, it's not always women. I mean, Sarah's father-in-law pioneered the Coke industry, and we associate Frick with the Coke industry of southwestern Pennsylvania, and we don't know Sarah's father-in-law so much. So I hope it inspires people to write about women or to donate artifacts about women to museums and archives so that researchers can find that. But in some cases, it'll be men that they're writing about or donating information to.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a sense of her personality?
It's hard to say, because sometimes I feel like I just project my own family members' personality mm-hmm. in a way, because they're the people that I came in contact with. I mean, from what I've heard from other people in Western Pennsylvania, she seemed like she was very sharp. Mm-hmm. And there was an article in the Religious Telescope, which was the United Brethren Church's newspaper, that specifically said that, you know, many educated men and men of, you know, high station essentially sometimes tried to get things past her and they couldn't. So I got the impression that, you know, she was shrewd, she knew what was going on, and she was the type of person who would stand up for herself. But she also struck me as someone who would have been very diplomatic, just because of the approach that she took with her suffrage rally or tea. Sometimes it was a rally, sometimes it was called a tea. You know, and the fact that she didn't seem to do things to glorify herself to other people. So she seemed to have a sense of humility about herself. When she built her mansion, it was on about 600 acres of land, several miles outside of town.
Wow.
So she wasn't building so that everybody had to walk past it every day and you know, behold the grandeur or something. It was really for her.
Oh, so she wasn't on the millionaire's row. She had her millionaire's acreage more, because the millionaire's rows, I mean, it's so interesting going in that, you know, like Pennsylvania and Michigan, they all, you know, the manufacturing areas. It just blew my mind. You'd go to a place like Erie, Pennsylvania, and this is where the waffle machine maker came from. And you'd be like, oh, you know,
okay,
they don't just come from hotels, you know, when you have the little express waffle thing. But anyway, no, but it's interesting about how that area was. And you think about these women and you think about history. I mean, it was still very new. I mean, we were still such a young country at that point. And here's here are these women doing things, you know. The museum part, you know, is interesting too. As we travel, we go to a lot of museums and we talk about what is going to happen as we move forward. What is happening with artifacts and papers? And a lot of them are digitizing everything as much as they can. I mean, there's a lot of financial and, you know, sweat equity that goes into that. And so I think part of what's so beautiful about what you're doing too, and for those doing this, even just going in and researching genealogy, you're letting a museum know where there's interest, and you're kind of giving that little prompt to protect certain things. And even when you put it into a book, there's some kind of documentation that goes further afield. And when you're doing the research, you're letting the museum know, hey, this is important. So things kind of don't get shelved away. And I know museums don't want to do that at all. So I'm not saying that. I'm just saying it kind of gives a little catalyst to take care of things, where sometimes, especially women, we can get brushed off a little bit, and we have in history. So it's important. I think books are so important, because especially those are digitized, you know? Yeah.
And when I was putting this together, I was talking with my editor about it, and we agreed that the bibliography should include all of the newspaper articles that had been used, even though that's not typically typical for a bibliography. But I wanted it to be the breadcrumb trail for someone else who wanted to do research on Sarah, or if someone was thinking about doing research on someone else and wanted a prototype or wanted ideas for sources, they could look at the bibliography in this book and get some ideas, because I didn't have special access to any particular archives or organizations. It was just a matter of calling or emailing and talking to people about what I was doing and putting that together. So anyone else would be able to contact college and university archives and historical societies and anything like that and do something similar depending on how much is available. And when I was doing this, I had a couple of primary sources that had been in the family that I donated to Methodist archives just so that they'll have something about Sarah in their collection if someone's doing research about women in the Methodist Church or churches that women built in the Methodist Church. So that was kind of nice to know that something was getting out of my file cabinet and into the hands of an organization to digitize it and make it available to anyone in the country, sure. The world.
I know. That's so nice. Our friend Glenn may be researching her, doing it the other way around. Where did she go in America from England, In your background, in business, and I know you've done a lot of studying and also understanding marketing, and did anything change for you through the research and writing of this book as a woman now in the world of business and thinking about, okay, now versus Sarah, anything new for you that you kind of went, some kind of learning thing from all of it?
I think it was more in the course of deciding to write the book. I thought about women I knew in my business career who were so interested in stories like these, whether they were obscure women from history or well-known women from history. They just seemed to really enjoy hearing the stories. And in some cases, I was on the board of an employee resource group for women at the company that I worked at for a number of years. And we would have a women's history programming. So we would have a few lunch and learns throughout the month about different subjects relating women's history to maybe something that our company was doing. So people had an hour to sit and learn something about women's history. And depending, this could be someone who was just out of college or someone who was near retirement. It could be someone who had never really studied history since college or high school. Mm-hmm. So the background relationship to the subject may or may not be there, but people just loved that opportunity to learn and to get information in kind of like small bites. Mm. So that was part of what informed me when I was writing this book. I wanted it to be something that anybody could read without necessarily knowing a lot of background on the person or the industry or the region, and something that wouldn't be 100 or 600 pages to read because a lot of people just don't have the time. So it had to be short, and that came being in business.
Mm. Oh yeah, get right down to it. Yep. We know about that. Edit. Mm-hmm. I know. Well, thank you so much for number one, writing the book, and everybody's out. It's out now. And here it is. The title is The Life of Sarah B. Cochran, the Coal Queen. Excuse me. That's her name. That's her name. You know what she's doing, but it's called A Lesser Mortal. See, the title, that blows my mind. I love that. A Lesser Mortal, The Unexpected Life of Sarah B. Cochran. So A Lesser Mortal. That's an interesting choice for the title, A Lesser Mortal.
Yeah, I thought that next to Carnegie and Frick, she was kind of outside of the historical narrative and getting treated like a lesser mortal in their particular world, even though there was nothing lesser about her. And her life unexpected in the sense that she probably didn't grow up expecting to do half the things that she ended up doing. I don't think anyone expects to find a woman running these businesses in her place and time. And I never expected to write the book about her. So it's just unexpected on a lot of levels too.
Right on. Well, everyone, you can get on Amazon, Barnes and Noble, all those places, but also go to your independent bookstore and ask for it if it's not there. So check it out. Do you have a website or a blog, or should people just go get the book?
I think it's just easier to get the book, or at this point, we've been using the Amazon authors page for any media about it. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for having me. Thanks.